America.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's the second hour of the show. Glad to have you listening. My name is David Inge. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. Different species of animals, probably all kinds of animals, including human beings, show behaviors that are typical of their species. And the question that we'll be talking about in this part of the show is, where do these behaviors come from? Are they things that are hardwired at the genetic level? Is it the kind of thing that you inherit from your parents? Or does indeed the environment in which you live play some kind of role in how those behaviors are expressed or whether those behaviors are expressed? These are the questions we'll talk about in this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Mark Blumberg. He's a neuroscientist at University of Iowa. He's the author of Body Heat, Temperature and Life on Earth. He has published many journal articles and chapters on topics including sleep, animal behavior, temperature regulation, and communication. He is associate editor of the journal Behavioral Neuroscience and is the author of a recently published book, which is entitled Basic Instinct, The Genesis of Behavior. It is published by the Thunder's Mouth Press and should be out in bookstores if you would like to read it. Questions, of course, here on the program, as always, are welcome. We ask if people just are brief, if that's possible, to keep the program moving and get in as many callers as possible. But people who are listening are certainly welcome to call in here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455. That is the number. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And if you're listening over the air around Illinois or Indiana, or in fact anybody who's listening on the internet, anywhere that you might happen to be, you can use the toll-free line. Well, as long as you're in the United States, I should add that qualification. You may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Professor Blumberg, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm good.
Thanks for talking with us,
sure.
I should say. At the risk of short-circuiting the program right from the very beginning, it seems that what we're talking about here is a kind of a discussion that's been going on for a long time. People have been thinking about this and talking about it for a long time, the nature-nurture sort of controversy. That is, you know, to what extent we are shaped on the one hand by characteristics that we inherit from our parents and our forebears, and to what extent the environment plays a role. And it seems that from time to time, there's a pendulum that sort of swings back and forth, and right at the moment, because of all that we have learned and continue to learn about genetics, we seem to be leaning a bit in the genetic direction, into the nature side of this. But it sounds as if what you're saying, and I think probably a lot of other researchers would say it, is it's not one or the other, it's both.
Yeah, that's definitely true. The pendulum has swung clearly towards these genetic explanations, and I would just say that these are not really explanations. And what's really been interesting about the history of this problem is that, you know, underneath this cavalcade of genetic, you know, storytelling that's been going on for some time, and a lot of it has led to very interesting information and important information, no question about that. But there's always been this sort of minority group that's been saying, hold on a second, these explanations don't work. You know, we understand more about development than this, and we simply can't, you know, simply bring up these genetic stories and tell them as if they things are as simple as they would they're told by many people.
Why is it that it seems we can't quite be comfortable with taking the middle position between the two poles?
You know, I think it's something I've thought about a lot. The way it was said to me by one person who deals with publishing a lot is that it's difficult to either talk about the middle position or any position that's not genetic in anything other than a soundbite. The genetic explanation just is so easily reducible to simple soundbite statements about, oh, it's genetic. And then people think that by saying that, they have engaged in some kind of scientific discourse, when in fact, I would argue that it's very similar to creationist thinking. It's very similar to, you know, intelligent design. It's basically magical thinking with respect to science. It has the patina. It sounds like science, but it really doesn't in any way capture the complexity of development and how things actually happen.
You explain in the book that you actually started thinking about this when you had a new dog come into your home.
Yes.
And it was a puppy, and it was a herding dog, and you know they do what they do, and you had a couple of other dogs, and of course the puppy decided, oh, okay, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, and herded the other dogs, and that got you thinking about the fact that, or asking this question. Well, that's pretty interesting. How did that happen? Why does it seem that this is just, you know, the dog comes with the program, and the program kicks in, and that's sort of that.
Yeah, it really does. Most scientists really, you know, they get interested in things for personal reasons. And I go back to my aunt's house in Maryland, and she was a breeder of Polish sheepdogs. Watching these, you know, these dogs just running circles around my cousins up and down the stairs, I was just fascinated by that. And then I put that in the back of my mind, and I went on with my career studying development and neuroscience and other things. And then I got this dog, and she was like no other dog I'd ever had. She was a border collie. Her name was Katie. We called her the demon. She had these blue eyes, you know, she stared down these other Bichon Frises we had, and it was just relentless terrorizing of these two little dogs. It was so clearly different, and it's so easy, you know, you just try to explain these very powerful behaviors, and I looked at this and I said, well, she's a herding dog. She must have, you know, her brain is programmed, genetically programmed to do X, Y, and Z, but the closer you look at it, you realize that everything this animal did became part of the herding instinct in my mind. You know, that just became part of the story. No matter what she did, oh, that must be part of the herding instinct. Until you realize that what you're talking about are some very specific things that she did for reasons that I really have no information on, have never compared to other breeds of that age raised in the way she was with her parents. And I started slapping myself, saying, you know, stop that. You're just telling more stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I started reading about the herding instinct from people who breed these animals, what I realized was that breeders don't know anything at all either. They tell stories in the same exact way. But what we do know about instincts, like the herding instinct, so-called, is that it's really it's composed of a variety of behaviors, a whole slew of behaviors, many of which are just look like herding, and others are essential, but you know don't really look like. So people who are engaged in breeding of dogs for herding talk about showing of eye, the staring down that they do. They also talk about barking. They talk about how the animal weaves around a herd, but also, you know, their ability to listen to commands is very important too. So their interactions with the herder and their interactions with herding with the herd that's going to be herded, all of that plays in as well. Mm-hmm. And then the more you look at it, you realize, oh boy, you know, this is just much more complicated than genetically programmed brains. This is a suite of responses and behaviors and organization and learning and breeding. All of these things play a role in the final, you know, working dog that we see.
Well, it's first of all, it's fascinating, and obviously the complexity that you suggest is there. And when you have interact with one of these animals, it's obvious that they are very intelligent, sometimes maybe smarter than you, and that they have this need to do certain things. I mean, working dogs, it just seems that they have the need to work. And I can understand the idea that maybe the behaviors wouldn't manifest themselves if you never gave them anything to herd, they couldn't do it. But on the other hand, I guess I'm still having a hard time with this idea that it isn't that somehow everything that's necessary for them to do that, to be able to learn what they need to do, to be able to interact with the human, to be able to understand that there are certain commands and that they, you know, when the human does this, he wants me to do this, that still seems in my mind to come down to it has to be something that is mostly about, you know, it's about neurological pathways, and it's about what's happening in the brain of the animal, and that learning can account for some of it, but that if the underlying structure wasn't there to accept that, for that to be layered on top of, then it wouldn't happen.
So great. I mean, so you've put your finger on the real problem. I mean, where does the it exist?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where is that instinct? And you know, whether you're talking about complicated behaviors like instincts or, you know, basic reactions or reflexes or even structures, you know, the development of bone or skin or any of these things, what we know about development is that everything happens in sequence and that if any step along the way is disrupted or doesn't occur in some way that is essential for that next step to take place, then the entire path goes off in a different direction. So the problem is, the way I put it is, it's an action at a distance problem. And in development, there can be no action at a distance. And there's nothing more distant than herding, from a herding behavior, than a gene. That's about as far away as you can get in time and space, you know, as is possible when talking about development. Genes exist inside cells. They are expressed in real time. Their expression is modulated by local, you know, chemicals in the environment. And if anything goes wrong along the way, you get a completely different outcome. And so that's the key. Can you imagine what would it be to say that a beaver herds, you know, a dam? I mean, a beaver builds a dam. What would it mean to say that that beaver has that dam building instinct in the absence of a creek?
Right.
I mean, isn't the creek just as essential to the expression of that behavior as anything that we would put inside the animal? It is about the relationship between the organism and its environment. And when we lose sight of that, that's when we get in trouble. So let me tell you another story.
Mm-hmm.
We had this new dog. Her name is Josie. She's a bearded collie, also a herding breed. But this dog is completely different. But what we noticed about her was that she loved to slap around water. And any time there was water in the environment, she went crazy. Now, if I were going to tell a story about this, I would say that this Josie was not, she had some water playing genes in her, or maybe she had been, you know, her ancestors were bred with Newfoundlands and they loved, you know, who were also water dogs, and maybe Josie was really a water dog in disguise. But then we found out from some other people that she was bred in Montana, and the particular breeder in Montana likes to put water pools out in where she breeds the dogs. And all of her dogs have this tendency to want to splash around in the water bowl, splash around in water outside, play with water hoses. Now, if I was going to tell a story about this dog, and if I had a reason to believe that there was something special about her being a water dog, I could easily talk about genes and instincts, when in fact I know for a fact that it's a specific trait, if you will, of all of the dogs that are bred by this breeder in Montana.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, though, that gets back to an idea you were talking about earlier, and again brings it back to mind that tells us something about human beings, and that is our need to explain things,
mm-hmm.
and to explain things in certain kinds of ways.
Right.
Just the way that you have.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, I guess, that it reinforces in my mind is the idea of the way that we talk about, the way that we use the term instinct, as if that is something that is so hardwired, it's just there,
mm-hmm.
that the herding dogs, they know how to herd, that cats know how to catch mice and, you know, whatever kinds of examples you want to give. And that indeed downplays the idea that there might be any kind of learning involved. And I'm sure that in a host of behaviors that would seem on the face of them to be instinctual, and again, when we use that term, it sort of means that they're automatic, that in fact there is learning that goes on, and we need to keep that in mind.
That's really true, and we also make the mistake of pretending that when we say the word instinct, we all mean the same thing from when we say it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are at least 8 or 9 different definitions floating around about instinct that people use interchangeably as if the distinctions don't matter. So I have no problem with saying that different species exhibit species-typical behaviors that are typical of, you know, dogs and cats and cows and humans. We have behaviors that that are adaptive. In a normal developmental environment, they lead to increased survival, increased, you know, reproduction. But the next step that people love to take is then to talk about the origins. And when we start talking about origins, that's when the problems really, really begin. Because the tendency right now, you know, the zeitgeist that we have now is simply to say it's genetic and move on. And there are all kinds of problems with that have been documented about making that leap and forgetting about all the critical links in between.
Our guest is Mark Blumberg for this hour of Focus 580. He is a neuroscientist at the University of Iowa, and he is interested in a number of things, including animal behavior and communication, also other topics like sleep and temperature regulation. He is the author of the book Basic Instinct, The Genesis of Behavior. It's published by Thunder's Mouth Press, and if you're interested, it's in the bookstores. Questions here, too, are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You just said a moment ago that perhaps one of the problems with talking about instinct is that different people may use the word differently. They mean different things by it. Is among scientists, particularly, I guess, people who study animal behavior, is there some sort of consistent way of using that word and of applying particular meaning to it?
No, it's been recognized for a long time that we're just not very careful about it. Steven Pinker, the noted author on human behavior, he wrote a book called The Language Instinct. He doesn't even bother to define the word in the entire book. and goes through talking about language instinct as if we all can agree what that means. We don't, as scientists. So we try to be very specific about the behaviors we're studying and try to be very specific about what we're doing and, you know, and the manipulations we're making and what counts as the behavior and what doesn't. So it's the care that normally comes with any scientific enterprise that helps get us out of this. But this is one of those words, you know, along with nativism and, you know, evolutionary psychology and all of these hot-button ideas today that's just rife with, you know, these linguistic, semantic problems that we seem to want to skirt because it makes it easier for us to say what we want to say. But in the end, of course, we just end up making things more cloudy.
Do you... Well, having said all that, are there behaviors humans exhibit that you would say might qualify for thinking about in this way?
Well, I think language is a perfectly fine example of a behavior that is adaptive, that clearly is special to humans in terms of the full variety of grammatical sentences that we're able to construct. At least that's the evidence that we have so far. But even if it weren't, I mean, we're clearly, as a species, we're fairly rare in our ability to communicate that way. So, yes. But also, you know, there's other things that we do. We walk upright. Now, that's not as special as we might think, but, you know, it's pretty special for us. And you know, walking upright is one of the things that makes us different from most other mammals. So, yes, there are things that we do that you could that qualifies as that. But, you know, then the next question is why? So there's a really fascinating example of a goat that was born in Holland in 1939. And this goat, because of some developmental anomaly, it was born without forelimbs. And this goat walked on its two hind limbs. Hmm. Now, that's pretty flexible behavior on the part of a goat. And this animal looked bipedal, you know, so it makes you wonder just, you know, how difficult it was for human beings to walk upright after all, because we have a tendency to think of it as a massively important evolutionary adaptation that required a great deal of, you know, of evolutionary predisposition. But in fact, it can happen very rapidly in an animal when you simply remove its forearms.
Hmm. Well, you know, I begin to wonder about this question of the expression of behaviors where there may be some sort of biological substrata in which they rest, but behaviors that rely on interaction with others of the same species for those to be expressed. And I think, for example, the issue of human language, I think one of the things we know is if you took a baby and you raised it in complete silence, no one ever spoke to it, it wouldn't speak. So that says, well, that human contact, that human interaction has to be there. And there are probably a lot of other things where as human beings develop, they look around at other human beings and they look at them and they watch them do stuff and they think, oh, okay, this is how we do it. And this is how we develop. And if it wasn't for that interaction, maybe those things wouldn't develop. Is that something that is general, that you can make a statement that is generally true, that is, for all species that's in some way interacting with their own, learning by seeing other, you know, seeing behaviors modeled is part of how why those behaviors get expressed?
Actually, yes, and you can generalize it. You can say it's not necessarily seeing. It's all kinds of often non-obvious developmental precursors that give rise to these things. So we often, you know, it's a very rational thing to think about that the final behavior must have its origins in these sort of smaller versions of that behavior or the little components of the behavior. But in fact, they could come from some very bizarre developmental events. I'll give you an example. Infant rats cannot urinate when they're born. Okay, this is a little bit strange, but bear with me. They can't urinate when they're born. The only way they can urinate is if their mother licks them in their anogenital region. That triggers a reflex. Now, those infants, it turns out that males are licked more than females because males have testosterone in their urine, and the females lick the males that have the more testosterone in their urine. And and this has been done experimentally, if you deprive those males of the testosterone, or if you somehow make the mother not lick them as much, those males grow up to be ineffective reproducers. They do not engage in normal sexual behavior because all of the licking that the mother gives to the pup actually stimulates the muscle in the that's connected to neurons in the spinal cord, which makes that whole system develop. Mm. Now, try to connect in your mind the rational relationship between helping a pup urinate and leading to normal spinal cord development, leading to normal sexual behavior in adulthood. And yet, if you take out any of those links in the chain, you lose that normal sexual behavior. Moreover, it turns out that that licking that the mother does on the pups actually changes the gene expression in the pup. So pups that get the licking actually have genes that are turned on or modified in their expression by that experience that they get early in development. Hmm. But this is typical. This is typical of the stories we're starting to get more and more of, that development is such a convoluted and irrational, non-obvious process. We fool ourselves into thinking that it must be more simple and linear and, you know, straight arrow than it really is. And that's why, you know, that's what's so fascinating about working in this area is discovering these types of things.
Well, that's a pretty dramatic example about the relationship between genes and environment, that something happening in environment either can make the difference when a gene functioning or not.
And that's true. And that's true of us whenever we learn something. Genes during our entire life, it's not as if the genes are expressed and then they're shut up and our lives go on. Genes are expressed differently throughout our lifetime, and when we learn new things, genes are expressed, which lead to the retention of memories. And so that is also ways in which experience, learning, leads to modifications in genes, which then leads to changes in the structure of our brains, which helps us to remember what we learned.
We have someone to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. A listener in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Morning. This discussion is fascinating. It reminds me of a quotation like, "In this world, mind goes more ghostly than a ghost." Perhaps you've heard that. In any event, I'm raising a golden retriever at this point in time myself.
Yes.
And in this question of, it's sort of a question, it can be a lot of questions, but it could be a question of cognition and reflection. Like, I noticed there's a hesitation, like you're playing with the dog, and he decides whether he's going to nip at you or lick at you. So, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's this pause where you could think of it as reflection about what he does next. If instinct is totally driving him, then he doesn't have a choice, does he? You know, I wonder if you'd address the concept of perhaps choice and volition in terms of instinct and, what would you call it, some intellectual overriding on instinctual behavior?
Well, you're right. There are a lot of questions in there. I mean, I think one thing that I think is fascinating that we all do is we sort of disembody the instinct. So when you said that the instinct sort of tells him what to do, I mean, isn't the instinct part of him?
Right.
Whatever it is. So, I mean, who's telling whom? You get into this sort of nested Russian dolls after a while. You're not really sure, you know, who the him is.
Right. I'm an old Platonic type person, so I have a tendency to...
No, it's a serious problem, because if we think about instincts as you know, very simple things, as actual things you can hold in your hand, then I think we're prone to think about it, you know, in a way that gets me confused anyway all the time. But I think to answer your question, you know, when you're playing or you're engaging in behaviors with your dog, I think it's actually very helpful then to see how your dog engages with other dogs. And they develop a vocabulary of sorts as to the types of signals that they will engage in that will then predict other types of behaviors. Whether it will go to an overdramatic, maybe, you know, very aggressive encounter that can lead to maybe even blood, or whether they're just going to always sort of bite down very softly and engage in what we would call play. And there are lots of subtle signals that these animals, people study these very subtle vocabularies that these animals develop. Some of them are very typical, you know, that you see in lots of different dogs. Some of them can be very idiosyncratic. But the play bow is certainly something that people talk about. When a dog kneels down on the two forelimbs go down on the ground, the head's close to the ground, and the rump is in the air. Mm-hmm. And that's called a play bow. And that generally is predictive of an animal that's going to be engaging in non-aggressive interactions. The tail is often wagging at the same time. So these are things that we pick up on, dogs pick up on. We often are predicting each other's behavior based upon these types of things. And dogs have very sophisticated play behavior. And if you sit down and you watch them, you can often figure out what those signals are.
I wonder if I could ask, would you have a book that you might recommend, especially about dogs, perhaps? Or more general, if not on dogs.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you try to do a search on play and dogs, I think one person is Mark Bekoff, Bekoff, who does a lot of work on play behavior in dogs. So that would be one place to start.
All right, thanks very much.
All sure.
Right, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. Let me introduce again our guest, Mark Blumberg. He's a neuroscientist at the University of Iowa. He's the author of the book Body Heat, Temperature and Life on Earth, and he's written many articles and chapters on various subjects. Temperature regulation is one of them, but also he's interested in sleep and animal behavior and communication. He is associate editor of the journal Behavioral Neuroscience and is author of the book Basic Instinct, The Genesis of Behavior. It's published by Thunder's Mouth Press. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to again, to stay with this, the nature-nurture question a little bit, and to talk about genetics, I'm just interested in one section of the book here that talks a little bit about twins. And I'm thinking about this because not very long ago I had here on the show, we talked with someone who had done a lot of research on twins, and we had talked about some of these famous twins reared apart studies, the ones where you have identical twins that were separated when they were babies and raised by different families in different places, and then you get the two twins back together again, and you find what seemed to be eerie
spooky
similarities. And that's what it says in the chapter book. It's spooky. Yes, spooky stuff. Where you have two guys that they're both volunteer firemen, and they like the same kind of beer, and they smoke the same kind of cigarettes, and they're both married to blonde woman named Shirley. And it seems to just go on and on.
Yeah.
And that seems to what's attractive about this is that seems to illustrate the way we tend to think about genetics. Here we have two individuals that are as similar genetically as two individuals can be. We take the whole nurture stuff out of it, and we have these amazing similarities. And how else do we explain them except that these two people are genetically almost identical?
Yeah, this is one of those things that drives a lot of us to distraction, because it's one of these fascinating things. It is spooky. It is eerie. A lot of it's unsubstantiated, but let's move on from there. Let's take them at face value. Let's deal with the famous Jim twins, Jim Springer, James Springer, and these two guys were, reared apart. About what actually qualifies as reared apart is often pretty interesting. It's not what you might think very often. Sometimes they can be meeting for a week, every week for 10 years, and they'll still be considered, to be reunited in adulthood. In any event. So these two guys, like you said, their dogs were named Toy, I think. Neither one of them, I think, liked to flush the toilet after they went to the bathroom. And they liked to go with their family, my favorite, in these light blue Chevrolets down to the same beach area of Florida. And so the response is, my God, how do we explain this, without it appealing to some remarkable genetic mechanism? And my response is, my God, do you really believe that there is a gene that actually would control the type of color car and make of car you like to drive down to a part of the world that we call Florida? I mean, if anyone believes that, and these people like the author you're talking about and the work she's talking about up in Minnesota by Thomas Bouchard, these folks are purveying, are promulgating these anecdotes. And they want to wow you. They want you to feel a bit of spookiness about it and then simply say, wow, aren't genes powerful? And my response is, wow, aren't these people magical thinkers? Hmm. If they believe that genes can actually do this, so how do we explain it? Well, it's the same thing that happens with dreams. A lot of people believe that dreams tell our future, because you have a dream one day and you wake and you go through your day and, my God, it comes true. The problem is that it's a statistical problem, because how many of us remember those dreams that don't come true? We don't. We forget them. We only remember the ones that are salient to us, that actually happen, that trigger that, aha, look at that, it came true. Those are the ones we remember. We forget the thousands or tens of thousands of dreams that never have any connection with anything in reality in our futures. And so really what we're dealing with here are coincidences. We're dealing with misreporting. We're dealing with a misunderstanding of statistics. It's all of those things, but there is simply no way that I can imagine, or anybody I know can imagine, that genes can control whether or not I'll buy a light blue Chevrolet and drive it to Florida.
So there are certain things that, if it turns out that both men have a tendency to have high cholesterol, that's one thing, but that there are so many other things that we would just have to say, that's interesting, and it's appeal. It fits in the pattern that we have already decided is there, but that we have to acknowledge the extent to which chance can play a role, and in many ways that we probably don't think very much about.
Yeah, it's It's just it's an industry. This whole separated twins thing is just it's an out of control industry for the way a lot of us think about it. Mm.
Let's talk with some other folks here. Urbana is next, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm intrigued at the evolution of cooperative behavior. I can imagine how cooperative hunting behavior might evolve because it's a really immediate feedback, or pretty immediate feedback sort of thing, as in dog packs or wolf packs. But I saw a television program that included birds cooperatively raising, or foregoing breeding, and cooperatively helping to raise the offspring of one pair of other birds. And you have any thoughts about that? Because it seems to me that the payoff isn't immediately obvious for the ones who aren't having offspring.
It's a great question. I mean, the standard, you know, there are many different ways to go in that, so let me just try a couple of different ones. One thing that's talked about a lot in the evolutionary biology literature has to do with what's called kin selection, and the idea is that you are, if you share genes, basically, if you share some reproductive, you know, relationship with your cousins or your brothers and sisters and parents, that anything that you do to make those relations more successful will benefit you indirectly, but still, because you share more with your closer relatives than with distant relatives, that there can be some benefit to that. But there are animals that have little loopholes in their ability to distinguish between their own and different young. And one great example would be cowbirds. These are nest parasites. Cowbirds will deposit their eggs in the nest of another species, and when those babies are hatched, they will then push out the eggs out of the nest, killing them, and the parents of that other species will then raise the cowbirds to the point where they are fledged and able to go off and lead the rest of their life. These animals simply do not have the ability to detect their own and others. And so I wouldn't call that cooperation. That's why it's called brood parasitism. These animals are parasites on other birds, and they take advantage of that loophole in their ability to detect. Rats also will raise young of other mothers, and they will often, you'll sometimes find if females are breeding together, and if they give birth close together enough, they will collect all the pups in one enormous nest. I've seen 15, 20 pups underneath a single mom many years ago when I was doing this kind of work, and the moms have no way of detecting differences between the young. So lions are very similar as well. So there are differences across different species as to what is and is not in their best interest, and in their ability to distinguish these things.
Well, I've seen with lions that there's an advantage to the females all giving birth at similar times, because mm-hmm. then if one female is off hunting or several, then one can stay behind and feed the ones that are the cubs that are still that are in her care.
That's right.
Or if a female is killed in the hunt, the other females can pick up and feed the cubs. So the pride, the group survives. But what I was referring to was the same species would care for the offspring of another member of the species,
mm-hmm.
a family cluster. I'm not sure whether they were related or not. I just thought it was really, really interesting. And it speaks to, I keep hearing people talking about gays not being normal because they don't have children necessarily, but it seems to me that there are advantages in a society to not have everybody busy focusing on reproduction, but also doing other things of society, and also, you know, contributing to the social welfare of the society and our children as a whole. Anyway, thanks a bunch for your thoughts.
Well, yeah, just along those lines, and if you think about, and the extreme of that is the social, the eusocial insects, like, you know, ants, where you have sterile ants, and you have the queen, and you have a variety of different types, and the developmental history of the animal determines whether and what type of ant they will become. They all share genes. So they're all participating in the colony and its survival, yet they all have very, very different roles to play in the colony survival.
I appreciate the caller's comments. Let's go to someone else here, Bloomington, Illinois, and this is line four. Toll-free
Hello.
Line. Hello.
I'm an alumni of Iowa, so it's great to hear you.
Uh-huh.
I was calling in, so I might have missed it, but just this is a really quick question, and then I have another question. Did you mention any statistics about all twins and whether the statistics bear out, whether all of, whatever percentage of these twins we can find out if there is more of a correlation with them or if they do tend to be more disparate on an average?
The person who does that work has not been open about sharing raw data with other investigators, which should raise some red flags right there.
Gotcha. Okay, so I have two questions. And the second one ties in. Anyways, I heard about the spirituality gene in the news. I remember some mention of this.
Mm-hmm.
And religion is obviously ubiquitous across all human cultures. And so I was wondering, to what extent we have an instinct or a drive to make religion, and to what extent it's just behavior that we learn. And then I have a second question, which I'm really interested in, and that is humans' connection to their environment, because you mentioned that, the beaver without a stream, where would its instincts go?
Yeah.
And where do humans' instincts go, and maybe where do they go awry with our changes in our culture, from hunter-gatherer to agricultural societies and then to industrialized societies? What are we missing there, and where are our instincts maybe misleading us as we change? And also then the religions do tie into that, because religions tend to be different for those types of cultures, and religion for a hunter-gatherer might be different, more connected to the land and such. So those are my questions, and thank you. I'll hang up.
Okay.
I'll try to be brief. All good questions. With respect to the spirituality gene, so-called, or the God gene, as it was portrayed on the cover of Time magazine, again, this is one of those stories that gets out there, and once it has that little soundbite associated with it, it's tough to deal with. But it's basically, and as last I heard, an unpublished study that involved a questionnaire looking at a questionnaire study of people from which they deduced that certain people were more spiritual than others, and it was an extremely small effect that the author of the study, the author of the book, then related to a particular gene that's responsible for in the regulation of one particular neurotransmitter. So that's, this is just such premature a speculation, and it's the way I think, I just think it's rather silly, to be honest, that you would go from such ephemeral, questionnaire studies to genes, to neurotransmitters, to God, and calling it a God gene. I just think that's just craziness. But, I guess the book sold a lot of copies. I'm not sure what the other...
Well, here's how I took the other question, is that if we're making the argument that the environment and the way that an individual interacts with the environment plays a role in how genetic predispositions are or not expressed.
Yeah.
If you take a look at human beings, and some people would, this is sort of what I see the caller going. Some people would make this observation that over time we have come increasingly disconnected from the natural environment in which we would have grown up a long time ago. And if we're not interacting with the environment in the same way, does that have some sort of impact on how it is that behaviors or tendencies to behave in certain ways are expressed?
Okay. Well, it's one of the tenets of evolutionary psychology, which is one of those things that makes me uncomfortable, because I'm an evolutionist and a psychologist, but I am not an evolutionary psychologist. Because there are certain, there are certain inferences that the folks who follow that they go to that I'm not willing to go to. But the evolutionary psychologists like to argue that we were sort of frozen in, Neolithic time, that we're hunter-gatherers and we're really sort of playing out these old scripts that were written for us in our brains and our genes, 100,000 years ago. The problem is really that it sort of assumes that we're not undergoing selection right now. The Black Plague, killed a lot of people. The influenza virus of 1918 killed a lot of people. The industrialization of dairy products leading us to be the only mammal that drinks milk after weaning. You know, and for people who are lactose intolerant, they know just how dismal it is to be lactose intolerant. They are the normal people. The lactose intolerant people are closer to our you know, more primitive condition than we are today, those of us who drink milk. There is very severe selection that can go on, and if this bird flu hits, there'll be selection that will go on as well. All of these things changes. All of these things change our interaction with our environment and each other, and for all we know, because we haven't been studying these things for very long, and we don't have records of our behavior from very long ago, we don't really know whether or not our behaviors are changing dramatically. But my guess is, as rather large-brained individuals, species, very complicated, very adaptive, that we are reflecting very much the environment in which we live. I remember trying to learn how to type when I was in junior high school and remembering how terrible that was. But something happened when the computer came along, the personal computer, and now how many of us even think about typing? How many of us remember even typing lessons? That is a very, very dramatic change in the way we interact with the environment. It's not genetic, but it does change certainly the way we are built and the way we process information and the way we live our lives.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking here about, we talked a little bit earlier about, I said, can you give an example of instinct in operating in humans? And right away you said the speech mm-hmm. would be one thing you'd give as an example. I'm thinking about the fact, though, that it seems like that we're much more accepting of the idea that instinct operates on other animals and not so much on humans, and we set up a lot of dichotomies, and one of them is instinct versus intelligence.
Yeah.
That somehow we think that animals can be pretty smart, but we're smarter, and they're much more governed by instinct than we are. And what's the impact of thinking that way about ourselves, as if instinct, we're much too smart to be governed by something like instinct?
Yeah, I would not necessarily subscribe to that. I mean, I think that there are enormous theological implications, ancient theological implications to this problem of thinking about, free will, determinism, think about determinism as instinct, free will as, what we do. It goes back to the notion, that humans, if we possess souls, and in order to be saved, according to conventional, sort of Judeo-Christian or mostly Christian, actually, theology, we have to choose between good and evil, and you can only do that if you have a soul. And making that choice also requires you to have reason, and reason is only possessed by us and by God. But what do you do when you see an animal that appears to be behaving rationally? Well, that's where instinct comes in. The origin of instinct as a concept was to try to give us a way to explain seemingly rational behavior in animals without giving them souls, without giving them reason, and therefore without having to give them the choice of good and evil. And so there are very deep issues here. When evolutionary thinking came along, people became very interested in pointing out how many instincts we have. They were interested in breaking down that chasm between animals, non-human animals, and humans. But humans are just animals. The question is, how are we different? I mean, that's a real interesting question. How do we explain all the ways in which we differ from other animals without getting into theological explanations, which are outside of the realm of science?
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Mark Blumberg. He's a neuroscientist at the University of Iowa. He's the author of the book Basic Instinct, The Genesis of Behavior. We have two callers here ready to go. We'll try to get them both in. The next is listening in Muhammad, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether your guest can talk at all about maybe manic depression or obsessive-compulsive disorder, mm-hmm. as it might relate to genetics and possibly the not just the environment, but the whole culture where that those traits are predominant.
It's a very hot topic right now, trying to understand the origins of these things. What you normally find, though, among scientists is people are searching for genes, depression genes, obsessive-compulsive genes. And this search invariably turns up some kind of, very high-profile publication, which is then discounted, disproved, and published in a very in the corner of the scientific realm. So the splash is made with the discovery, and when we find out that it wasn't that simple or simply was not that way at all, that information is not disseminated very widely. So many of these problems that you talk about have to develop They have to come from an interaction of the genes and the environment and everything that's going on. But what we know about a lot of problems that are happening, we're starting to learn about more things like cardiovascular disease. A lot of these problems are set up in early development. They can happen in the embryo. They can happen in early postnatal environment. And until we understand more about the pathway to these things, for example, you know, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's on the island of Guam have been related to the eating of a particular flower from a cycad plant, which actually is a plant which, when eaten by pregnant mothers, preferentially kills neurons that are developing at that moment. And you don't see the problems in the brain until way when these babies then grow up to be older, and then they show Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Now, this is one path, may not be the only path, to this. Cycad plants are relatively rare in the rest of the world, but that is one path by which you can get to these things. And until we open our minds and really look at the full array of developmental processes that give rise to these things, then we're going to be stuck, you know, looking for genes and going off on these tangents that don't get us to the real cause.
Okay, thank you.
All right, sure. to next someone on a cell phone here, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, you know, when you really want to put a percentage on, I think most people seem to assume that we're so much farther removed from animals in many things. If you were going to say we were much closer to animals than we would like to imagine ourselves to be in a certain percentage way, it would be very difficult to do that. But because we are like 98% similar to a chimpanzee, some people just feel very unnerved by that, but that meaning that we might be closer to them in behavior and many other things. What do you think about that?
Great question. I mean, my personal opinion is that we're just animals. I mean, I would never put a percentage on it. When I play with my dog or I watch what my dog does during the day, eating, drinking, going to the bathroom, or in their case, going outside, I have a lot of trouble distinguishing myself as an animal from them. I just think that it's overwhelming, you know, just the similarities between from structure to physiology to the structure of our brain to our behavior. But, of course, I'm not a dog, and a dog is not me. And, you know, we are different, but we're different in ways that don't make us not animals. They just make us a different species. And that's all. I mean, that's all. For me, it doesn't unnerve me. It actually, just the opposite, it actually comforts me.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
All right. Thank you for the call. And we'll go on here again to another caller here. This is line number 2, and that's Chicago. Hello.
Yes. People are saying humans are just animals or just a shade removed. Of course, the area of the mind and consciousness is a great nebulous area that's undergoing exploration. Mm-hmm. Have you gotten into that aspect that may even cover clairvoyance and psychic things? Could you comment on that?
Sure. I mean, you know, even among serious scientists studying consciousness, I'm often uncomfortable with the fact that just as with instinct, people do not often, you know, define what they mean by consciousness. When we get to areas like clairvoyance, ESP, these types of things, then I would say that those are definitely not within the realm of science, because we have plenty of evidence now that shows that at least the cases that have been held out as evidence of that turn out to be flawed or fraudulent. And moreover, until someone can show me, anyway, personally speaking, a mechanism by which I could communicate through an unknown physical channel to another individual, then I'm simply not going to take those claims very seriously. I mean, this, to me, again, is magical thinking. I'm very much into trying to understand, you know, the moment-to-moment, the physical interactions between all of the things in development that give rise to these complicated behaviors. And, you know, consciousness, whatever that is, at least most people who study it scientifically do not understand it as apart from the brain. They see it as an extension of the activity of the brain. But when you talk about clairvoyance and ESP, now you're getting outside of that realm, moving into the spiritual almost, with no physical connections between objects that are communicating with each other. That no longer really is within the realm of science.
Thank you.
All right. We are coming down to the point here. We have maybe a minute or two left. And you talked earlier about mentioned the fact that you are a psychologist. As a result of doing all this thinking and some of the things that we've talked about, does this help one understand human psychology better, do you think?
I think it does. I mean, I think that psychology has always had with it, buried within it this tension between sort of what you would call the natural science side of psychology, which is very closely related to neuroscience and biology. You know, my field is biopsychology, an actual melding of those two ideas, and more of the social science end of psychology, which is oftentimes it can be clinical or social psychology or personality psychology. And I think that there's often been this tension in trying to have a common vocabulary. And I think that, you know, this is good for psychology. It's good for all of us to think about these things and to demand, you know, to insist that we come up with explanations that are testable, that are grounded in the real world, things that we can see and measure and examine carefully and rigorously. So I think it's good for the field for us to have these types of debates.
Well, I want to say, Professor Blumberg, thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest, Mark Blumberg, he is a neuroscientist and professor at the University of Iowa, has worked in a number of different areas, is author of the book Body Heat, Temperature and Life on Earth. He is also the associate editor of the journal Behavioral Neuroscience. And if you would like to read in this area, you can look for the book that we've talked about. The book is titled Basic Instinct, The Genesis of Behavior. It is published by Thunder's Mouth Press and should be out now in the bookstores. Programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Focus 580, this program is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Tomorrow morning on our program, we'll be talking about farm subsidies, their impact on the global economy, and try perhaps to talk about the subject in a way that it's going to make sense to people who are not involved in agriculture. Our guest will be Robert Thompson. He is a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics here at the University of Illinois. That will be hour number one. Then in the second hour, it's a health care topic, something that we do from time to time. We'll be talking about the back and care of the back. And whenever we do this, we always get a lot of questions. Our guest for the show will be Dr. James Harms. He is a surgeon at Carl Clinic's Spine Institute. That will be tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. And now we hope that you will stay tuned because there's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with Joshua Schenck. He is the author of the new book, Lincoln's Melancholy. Schenck says President Lincoln was challenged by depression. It afflicted him for much of his life. But Schenck also reports that Abraham Lincoln drew strength from his battle with depression. We'll talk with Joshua Schenck this afternoon at 1:06 Central Time. Let's take a look now at commodity prices, beginning with Kansas City.